It is time to bring in David Terechuk. It's time for the Media Beat. You can find David at his website, which is themediabeat.us. Find David here live on a Friday morning and also, of course, on demand, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand. Click on the Media Beat. He is also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And good morning, David.
Well, hello to you. It's the afternoon for me. I'm in Italy, Marshall. It was so interesting hearing you play a version, at least, of Sweet Home Alabama. I'm now in Sweet Home Tuscany. but the performers, the Red Army Choir, touched me. It's an extraordinary version. I was glad to hear it. Here in Italy, this may not have been reported in the midst of 4th of July and very sort of introspective looking American media for the moment. But here in Italy, the government has been playing host to Vladimir Putin from Russia on July 4th and July 5th. I have to give you a satire warning before this comes up because people can take things all too seriously. But one of the Italian satirical jokes of the moment is that one of the things Putin said in his press conference here was he was commending his protege, Donald Trump, on a splendid and respectful duplication of the Kremlin military parade in Washington on July 4th.
You heard when he misread the teleprompter, right?
Yes.
And he said they manned the airports back in the Civil War, but of course. That's the danger of trying to read a teleprompter in a rainstorm.
Well, his other mistake in terms of air transportation was to say, and I think rather tellingly, this is not in his speech, but in his considerable pre-publicity for the speech and the event. He referred to Aircraft One instead of Air Force One, his own presidential airplane. And, of course, Aircraft One is indeed Vladimir Putin's official transportation. So he's a little mixed up in his references, but you can understand why.
So you're in Italy now, and I have to ask you, how's the weather?
Oh, it's extremely hot, even for this part of the country, which gets very warm in July, generally speaking, but now it's even hotter. It's approaching 100 degrees on some days. Today is a little bit cooler. We had a massive thunderstorm last night, which cooled things off a bit, but it seems to be creeping up again, too. Europe as a whole is enduring a terrible heat wave. It's a big problem for many countries. Italy less so because it's kind of used to some high temperatures. But even so, it's inconvenient for a lot of field workers, especially.
You know, it's interesting.
I've just been watching people making hay bales, and they're obviously having a terrible time.
But it's interesting you say that about Europe because in India, of course, we speak with Arjun Singh every week. There's one city that's lost its water supply, and there are actually some portions of India now where they say it's almost too hot for inhabitation. And by the way, if you were in New York today, it would be 92 or 95 degrees. So you're I think you're better off where you are.
Well, at least we've got extraordinary views from our windows, which we would not get in New York City. We can see the whole sky, not the little tiny slice of it we get to see in New York so much of the time. And there's a nice through breeze, which I suspect will not be happening in the canyons of New York City.
All right. So it must be interesting for you as an American citizen to view the 4th of July from over there and almost like on the outside of the fishbowl looking in at it. What is the attitude this big hubbub over the 4th of July celebration? I think most people really were upset more about the additional cost of about adding about $80 million to it. But what did people over in Europe and Italy, what do they think about what was going on over here?
Well, those who are aware of American history, and a surprising number of Europeans are, I have to say. Well, I shouldn't be surprised. I mean, I think many Americans are surprised when they come here to discover how well-informed Europeans are about America. And the same is not true in reverse, of course. Italians and other Europeans know for them, in many ways, the most important thing to know about America is that it was the creation of a relatively recent vintage, only 200 years, you know, and Europeans can say that, only 200 or so years old is the United States as a country. And as a consequence, they hold it up in many ways, a lot more idealistic than Americans themselves. They see America as a modern nation, espousing modern virtues like democracy, throwing off the wearisome and burdensome mantle of old systems like monarchy and the feudal system. And that, of course, is what America means to them, something free, something new, something open, something fresh. And so they're a little surprised to see, well, not a little surprised, very surprised to see this presidency in many ways, in their terms, turning the clock back. And it's a certain degree of, deep concern, really, about the National Day of this country, which they associate with the Statue of Liberty, Lady Liberty standing there in New York Harbor welcoming everyone. And they know that that's under threat at the moment. And few things epitomize that more than the fact that Washington started to look like another old-fashioned authoritarian kind of Eastern European state with, as the New York Times headline put it for yesterday, saying Trump, flanked by tanks, pleads for national unity. I mean, that sounds like a very old style Cold War period Eastern European thing to do.
It's interesting how Americans are so preoccupied. I was wondering, where you are in Italy and taking a look. I mean, does what's going on in England with the government in England carry as much water with people in the news as these some of these stories out of the United States?
Well, it's closer. They feel more concerned about Britain leaving the common market, which is what the EU used to be called, in a very clear indication of what's at stake here. It's all about markets, after all. And of course, America is demonstrating that it doesn't want to be involved very much in the notion of collaborative international markets. The whole idea of tariff wars that America's engaging in now is anathema to most Europeans. But in terms of relative importance, of course, the Italians are much more concerned about what's happening to Europe, occasioned in part, but it's not the only thing at work here. It's occasioned in part by Brexit, the fact that one country wants to leave this European Union of 28 countries and is in the process of doing so, although still not accomplished, of course. Many, many delays and complications when someone's idea bumps up against reality. Which is what's happened for the Brexiteers in Britain wanting to leave Europe. And Italians think of this as an irritation and a threat, though, of course, the sheer numbers in the end weigh most heavily. They know perfectly well that Europe's going to be pretty much the same without Britain. It'll be one country less out of 28, although, of course, an important one. But on the whole, they don't think it's going to be the end of the world in the way that some fearful people in Britain think it's going to be when they find themselves on the outs from Europe.
We're speaking, of course, with David Taracek, the Media Beat. Now, you had a pretty interesting segment on PBS about prisons. You know, prisons in this country, private prisons and private prisons that house adults and kids. But you did a whole segment on PBS on prisons.
Sure. I mean, as you were saying before, it's in a way very instructive for someone like me to come from the United States, where I am a citizen as well as a citizen of the United Kingdom. But I live in the States and I operate as an American journalist. But it lends a lot of distance to come to Europe and look with some kind of perspective back on the United States. And especially in my own mind at the moment, having just finished this report on one aspect of the American justice system, which has not been reported on much by the mass media in the States. And that's what happens when people get sent to jail. Jail as opposed to prison, I'm talking about. Yep. Although, as we know, and as you alluded to, the vast the prison industrial complex, as I've heard it described, is extraordinary. It's ballooned enormously over the last few decades. America now leads the world, at least the Western world, in the number of people that it sends, the proportion of its population that it sends to prison. But even in the short term, yeah, stays behind bars in what we call, in Americans especially, we'll make the distinction, they're called specifically jail, which is pre-trial custody or short-term sentences. When people are sentenced, people will spend them in county jails or city jails. Well, that population too increased enormously over the last few decades, and only recently, with a lot of outcry from bipartisan sources, both Republicans and Democrats in local and state governments, are paying close attention to this problem now. And at long last, amazingly, the overall jail population is going down. However, and this is what I wanted to report on, that is not true for women. And the proportion of women in jail is now creeping up, more than creeping up. In the last 8 years to be precise, over this last decade, the population of men has gone down and the population of women has stayed pretty much the same. So, as I say, the system as a whole is tilting more towards a female population. And the consequences to that, in terms of the social impact, the impact on families, is that much more serious when a mother goes to jail than a father. It seems lots of studies show that, and indeed many, and it reveals the causes too, because one of the main reasons that there are more women sent to jail is that they're more vulnerable economically. Their income compared with men who are in a similar position, being arrested and put in jail, they are 30% less in terms of their income than what men in a similar position earn. So they can't raise bail. So they stay behind bars. And they're much more likely, because they're concerned about, most of all, being reunited with their children, they are much more likely to take a plea deal and plead guilty and spend more time served behind bars. And that altogether contributes to a changing pattern, gender pattern in our jails. It's not really been remarked upon sufficiently, I don't think, in the American media.
No, and the American media, but it's not just the American media, I'm afraid. Why don't we just drop American out? I mean, for this particular situation, yes, it's an American situation and the prison industrial complex. Once you start looking into any of these things, you're going to find a lot more. It's not, you can't even say nuance. There's a lot more information than you're actually being given, and I just think that that's pretty much a crime against humanity. It's a crime against the human brain, what the media, I'll just say globally, is doing. So I think
Jill, that's a very justifiable criticism. However, I think it's a bit broad brush. I mean, I think almost by definition, the media are never going to completely cover all the detail of any issue or any story.
We're not talking about details.
However, that places the responsibility on us as journalists to make sure we counter that tendency. It's our job to try and put in as much nuance, as you say, or as much understanding of the facts, as well as just simply the facts, whenever we do a report on anything. And that's certainly been the principle behind the best kind of journalism in America, in Europe, and around the world, I hope.
And one of the something that you are aware of is that there is a bloodbath, so to speak, within the media business right now, because in a lot of cases, if you are looking forward, there doesn't seem to be as much of a plan for how to keep it sustainable. But in the looking backward department, people are still yanging away. And I'm just fascinated by this. You know, I am keeping an eye on what's happening in L.A. with the L.A. Times, which is it's got a following. It's reconnecting. I don't know whether they're going to make it or not, but it's reconnecting with a bunch of people that are more interested in having a. And when I say paper, I'm not literally talking about. You know, I don't care about the what it's actually printed on.
The format.
Right. Yeah. I don't care about the format as much as I care about being able to. And this is a bad word, being able to inform a citizenry. And I'm watching with interest how you know, there are people who are still more actively interested in getting clicks than informing a citizenry. And I don't know what we do about this, but I do know that, or I know that I hope that someone is paying attention. And one of the what's the humor quotient like in Europe?
Well, humor is not quite as broad as American humor. Let's put it that way. It's a little more sophisticated, if I can use a value-laden judge like that, judgment term like that. But sure, I mean, there's a dry wit in Europe, which is rare to find in America, I have to say. But why do you ask?
Because misery is not going to end up selling a lot of paper. A friend of mine who lives. No, you think I'm joking?
That is so very, very, very true. I have to acknowledge that. Yeah, bad news, misery, as well as blood and turmoil, will sell more papers, will gain more clicks, and so consequently has influenced the business pattern and the professional practice of journalists around the world ever since there's been a slate with scratchings on it that people would read out in the town square. If information provision is going to be a business, then it needs a business model. And that's, I think, the crossroads we're at now. When you talk about new examples of ways to do things like the Los Angeles Times, we'll also look to other forms of business plans that people are experimenting with, like subscription ideas, where it's more on the model of America's pattern of cable television, and you subscribe and you get what you subscribe for, and you get exactly the kind of thing that you want as a subscriber, and there are other models as well. But you're right in the general observation that there needs to be a lot more effort devoted to simply delivering what's important to people, not in terms of their immediate clickbait sort of reaction, but because, again, some kind of tabloid headline or photograph is dragging you in, but a genuine appeal to people's need for information upon which they can base their decisions as citizens. And that's always the challenge for journalists. Some of us do it energetically and rigorously. Others do it a little more sloppily. A lot of us do it very sloppily, I'm afraid. And at times, even the best of us end up making pretty bad mistakes because we know we're in a business which is numbers driven. We want to get our message to the greatest number of people, after all. That's a laudable motive, but often it can outweigh the other ones, and that's dangerous.
Yeah, and as I say, I will be watching with interest because there are a group of young, when I say young, kids who are just going into just going into life, just finishing college, just starting college, who do not share their parents' commitment, I suppose. Let me rephrase. Who are more committed to having good information and living their life than sitting around navel-gazing about how horrible it all is.
And, right. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
They're going to, at some point, need some information, just again, so that they know what's going on. And it's just, I watched this very much with parents on social media, and I've said this before, but my this image that is seared into my brain occurred on 75th in Amsterdam in New York City, and it was what was once, it's that corner restaurant that was, it might be called the Amsterdam Ale House now. It was once J.G. Mellis. It's been a lot of things, but there are tables outside. And it was a summer's day, and I can't remember whether it was 2 years ago or 3 years ago, whatever. And there was a family of, they were definitely New Yorkers. It was a family of four. And the kids were, I would say, 8 and 10 or 9 and 11, and the parents were whatever, and the parents each had a device, and the kids, all they wanted was attention. It's like, hey, this is cool, but the parents weren't talking to each other. Each parent was having its own moment on its own tablet, and the kids were left, when I say, no pun intended, I have to say this, the kids were left to their own devices, but it was just, I had to, but.
Well,
that's
a sad picture, you paint, Jill. It's interesting, I've been dining a lot in restaurants with large Italian parties that are all family-based, extended family in many cases, and it is extraordinary to see how everyone in this country walks around with a mobile phone, but at mealtime they sit and they talk to each other, and they engage with children, whatever age. The 20-somethings I see are as engaged in discussion, from my limited Italian, I can tell is about nationally important issues of the day with their parents and grandparents. The younger ones engage in conversation as well, and not always at the same level, but that doesn't matter. Everyone is engaged, and engaged person to person, eyeball to eyeball, not that horrible thing that I see so often. Certainly in New York City, people in small groups at restaurant tables, all of them looking down, never looking at each other,
and not actually.
But I'll say this about the media. I'll say this about the media industry as a whole, and maybe coming to a turning point in terms of getting people's attention and attention for important things of great. Breadth and significance is that it's internet driven, and yet at the same time, what's happening is out of the internet driven media landscape, which can be so downwardly plunging. At the same time, you're getting new developments. I think Axios was an example of that. There's Medium, there's Quartz. There are other places developing online which appeal to that need that you were describing, that younger people are feeling, for genuinely informative and broadly based explanatory material.
Yeah, and it is serving it. Marshall has just informed me that we have 2 minutes left. I will say one thing that I find quite interesting about the Axios model and so forth, and what I would throw in as an adult, and that is they do word counts and time counts because people are so busy. And
time counts is the most terrifying signal, isn't it? At the top of an article, it tells you this is 2 minutes worth of reading. I'm not sure I want to know that before I start something. But I think that is a reflection on the audience and its conditioning. And I'll fess up to being influenced by it now, even without the warning in front of me that this will take so many minutes or so many seconds. I find myself when reading, if I can call it legacy media, if I'm reading a paperback book, for instance, I turn a page and I see that it's not divided into short paragraphs, then automatically, it seems, my heart sinks. And I find myself bracing myself for a long, hard read. Well, there's nothing wrong with that, but I can see that our brains are getting conditioned to expect and operate within the short attention span. And that's the most dangerous thing that's happened because of screens.
I couldn't agree more, and we will continue. But meanwhile, enjoy the humor. Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, The Media Beat.
Thank you. Join you next week.
Live from Italy, David Tereshchuk with
Tuscany,
The Media Beat.
From Tuscany, no less.
And you can find David online here at Robinhood Radio at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on The Media Beat with David Tereshchuk.